Beyond the Burr Oaks, Chapter 9. After a few steps in the dry, drifting snow, I came to a halt with a curse. The snow was sifting down my shoe tops and biting into my bare ankle. Kneeling, I slipped my leggings hurriedly. Then I made for the Lane cabin, 12 miles down the road, for it was there I felt sure Roy would be. 2 miles of the trail covered, and my strength began to dwindle. But on I staggered, bareheaded, through the darkness, with the shifting snow cutting my face and causing my eyes to water until my eyelashes were a mess of icy snow. Little did I realize that a blizzard was blowing, for my thoughts were aware of those in the little cabin 10 more miles ahead. It was for a few words with them, and to get Roy, that I had sacrificed everything. The only thing that would stop me from reaching the cabin was death. 6 miles, half of the wearisome journey was over, when I threw myself, fatigued and cold, beside the road to rest. The biting cold soon gnawed its way through my flimsy clothing, making me so miserable that the weariness was forgotten. Rising to my feet, I once more faced the furious gale. On and on I trudged over the snowy, uneven road. Accompanying each step was a dull, tiresome pain in my weary legs. How long the remaining miles seemed! Then, as the old landmarks became more familiar, with the cabin but 2 miles ahead, my legs gradually became numb, and my whole body called for rest. A drowsy feeling, which was irresistible, overcame me. How well I knew what this feeling was! I was freezing, and little did I care. There was no pain, just an overly tired feeling. I could only lunge ahead 2 or 3 steps at a time. My left foot was almost useless. Halting at a small tree, I kicked my foot against it to get the blood circulating again. In doing that, I lost my balance and fell in the snow, where I lay without enough energy to rise. Slowly, I began sinking into a sleep. The crunching of the snow made me open my eyes long enough to see what appeared to be the form of a giant looming over me. Then, the rough handling which I received caused me to regain my senses now and then, and to realize that someone was laboring under my weight. All of a sudden, he stumbled. It was then that I became conscious long enough to recognize my rescuer. It was Slim, the sneering stranger who, but a few nights ago, had tormented me with his taunts. Getting to his feet, he grasped me roughly and was about to pick me up when I protested. "I think I can walk, Slim, if you'll give me a hand." "Try it then," he said, helping me to get up. My feet were numb and like clubs, making walking mighty difficult and slow. Slim did not utter a word until the light of the Lane cabin flickered through the trees, when he asked through clenched teeth, "I wonder if that thar skunk of a Roy Tanner is here at the Lane place?" "That's what I'm anxious to know," I mumbled weakly as we entered the gate. "Hark!" he commanded softly as I was about to say something. "I'll walk ahead and see if he's in thar. And you take this and stay here. Don't leave him by you. Plug him full of lead." I stood where he left me, gripping the old .38 Colt revolver which he had given me. "Guess you may as well give me back that bean shooter," he said as he returned, "'cause thar's no one in there but the old lady and she's all soaked up with tears. He took my arm again, and we approached the cabin. Knocking on the door, we waited a few minutes, but received no response. Slim, being impatient, grasped the knob and flung the door open. There, at the kitchen table, sat Mrs. Lane, with her head buried in her arms. "Guess she must be asleep," remarked Slim as we entered. "Auntie," I called. "It's me, Ken." I tried to walk over to where she sat and would have fallen, but Slim caught me and helped me over to her. Laying my hand on her shoulder, I started to speak again. But when my little finger happened to touch her neck, she was cold as ice. "My God, Slim, she's dead," I cried. He only nodded. "I wonder where Dora can be," I pondered. "Maybe she has gone for help or to call a doctor." "What's that in the old lady's hand?" asked Slim, at the same time removing a much wrinkled piece of paper from Mrs. Lane's clenched fist. Glancing at it a minute, he handed it to me. I looked it over two or three times without pausing. It read, "Dear Mother, I'm going away to the city for a day or so with Roy. He has done so much for us in our time of need that I feel we owe him much, so we are going to be married. Don't worry, for we will be back with you soon. With love, Dora." "A broken heart," I asserted with quivering lips. "And it sure is enough to break the dear old lady's heart," I went on. "First, old Dave passed away after many months of illness. Then her only child, a daughter at that, left her to marry a worthless person like Roy Tanner. And more than likely, she had pictured me as one who had turned to drink and neglected them after all they had done for me." "Where is the nearest telephone?" Slim asked at length. "At Shoals," I replied. "Well, I'll go and notify the doctor what's happened. He'll know what to do better than we would," Slim said as he replenished the fire. "I'll take one of the horses from the Lane barn," he concluded. "And just afore I go, I'll get you a tub of cold water and some snow for your feet, and you can thaw them slowly." Having carried in a pail of snow and a half a tub of cold water, he buttoned his coat tightly about his neck and went to the door. "Now, if I'm not back when the doctor comes and they take you back and lock you up, why, just keep me out of the trouble, and I'll have a chance to fetch back this dirty cur that's double-crossed me and has done worse than that to you. So just stand pat," were Slim's departing words. "All right, Slim," I answered, not paying much attention to what he was saying. For an hour I sat there, rubbing my feet with snow and holding them in the cold water, until gradually they began to thaw. What intense pain! I cannot express it in words. I was not far from the stove, so I managed to keep the fire burning by shoving in a piece of oak once in a while. The sun was 2 hours high that morning when the doctor drove in the yard. Accompanying him was the sheriff and another man. Before they reached the house, I managed to crawl into a clothes closet. There I sat, in pain, listening. They knocked twice before they entered. "Looks as if someone must have been here in the last half an hour," declared the doctor. "Guess you're right," agreed the sheriff, "for there's a good fire in the stove. And look at here. Someone has been splashing water on the floor around that tub some time during the night, because it hasn't dried up yet. Whoever it was that called me up and told me he had laid Mrs. Lane in the bedroom may have been here and gone to the barn or to a neighbor's," said the doctor, going into the bedroom where Slim had carried Mrs. Lane. "Guess I'll take a hike out to the barn, doctor," said the sheriff, "while you look at Mrs. Lane." "Very well," replied the doctor, going about his task. "There is nothing I can do here," remarked the doctor to the stranger who had accompanied them. "It seems like the strain has been too much for her, and she has died of nothing else but a broken heart."
"Shh," whispered the stranger. "Did you hear that smothered sneeze?"
I did not hear the doctor's reply, for I began to sneeze again, trying to smother the sound by burying my head in an old overcoat. The closet door was pushed open, and the stranger stood, gazing down upon me. "Who are you?" he demanded, his eyes roving from my head to my feet, where they came to a halt as he noticed how red and swollen they were. "I believe this is the fellow the sheriff is looking for, isn't it?" he asked, turning to the doctor. "Correct you are," assured the doctor, craning his neck to look over the stranger's shoulder. "But what's the matter with those feet?"
"Guess I froze them."
"Can you walk?" asked the doctor.
"Nope."
"I better look at them then," offered the doctor, "or you may lose them." I consented with a nod, and they lifted me from where I lay and put me on a chair. "Did you rub those feet in snow?" queried the doctor dryly.
"Yes, sir."
"You done well. They naturally will swell and be very sore for a while, but otherwise they appear to be as good as can be expected."
"Ha! So there you are," exclaimed the sheriff when he returned from the barn.
"And where has my prisoner been all through this cold night? Drinking some more hooch?"
"I can see no reason to torment this young fellow," remonstrated the doctor. "He is in plenty of misery as it is with them feet of his. They've been as close to being frozen as any I've ever seen."
"Well, you remember that wound on my head that you dressed last night, don't you, doctor? This is the imp that done it, and I figure I've got plenty right to abuse him some."
"I don't agree with you there," challenged the stranger.
"How's that?" growled the sheriff.
"Because, if I'm right, this is the lad that you arrested at the still. And, as you said last night, he claimed he was doing it to help these Lanes when they were destitute, and someone double-crossed him. Then you arrested him, and he pleaded with you to come here to the Lane cabin as his messenger. You refused. Well, he has sacrificed everything just to help those he loved, and death has beat him to it. So I think I'd be inclined to be lenient."
Bowing his head, the sheriff sauntered to the window where he stood for some time, as if ashamed.
"I presume you'll want this young man to accompany you back, won't you, sheriff?" asked the doctor.
"Is he in shape to go?" questioned the sheriff with a sneer.
"Yes, if we bundle him good," responded the doctor dryly.
"Let's go, then," suggested the sheriff.
"Very well," agreed the doctor.
"If you and Mr. Leland will wrap Mrs. Lane's body in blankets and carry it out to the sleigh, I'll fix this lad up comfortable."
Oh, Thank you.